I'm Richard Dodd, and you're listening to the Ecology Academy podcast. This is a show where we get to talk and learn about all things ecological, including interviews with top ecologists, both employers and employees, those working with ecologists, and also aspiring and inspiring career-seeking individuals setting out to make a difference. The show aims to provide you with insights, advice, and inspiration to help you succeed and excel as an effective ecologist and to make a real difference to our natural environment. Joining me today on the Ecology Academy podcast, we have Sarah Garrett, Chief Operations Officer, and Andy Buxton, Head of Science from NatureSpace. So good morning to you both.
Good morning, Richard.
Excellent. Right, so we're going to jump straight into it. So, Sarah, please do tell me a little bit about yourself, and also before we go into NatureSpace itself, just about your background in terms of where you got to in terms of NatureSpace today.
Thanks, Richard. I'm Chief Operations Officer at NatureSpace. I've been working with NatureSpace for the last 6 years, 7 years, developing a strategic licensing approach, which we're going to talk about a little bit more. And I suppose I got into this through protected species licensing work, working in a local planning authority as a planning ecologist, and just a general interest in all things European protected species.
Excellent. Great. And Andy?
So yeah, I'm Head of Science at NatureSpace. I've been involved with the scheme since before it was launched in various guises. So originally as an advisor, and then did a lot of the habitat creation and statistical modelling that underpinned the scheme before my current role. Before that, my PhD is from the University of Kent, looking at environmental DNA error rates, so survey error rates, detection probabilities, false positives, false negatives, things like that, and sort of operationalizing eDNA as a survey method. Before that, I was a consultant, actually sitting, I had a desk in the building that you're currently sitting in, Richard. Oh. above where you're sitting right now. So that was five years as a standard commercial ecologist for an engineering company.
Well, okay, well, we're looking after the building, don't worry. You know, obviously, it's a lovely building. I say at the moment that we can hear the water flowing underneath the mill building. So it got a bit scary last week, but yeah, the floor was still dry, so that's good.
it wasn't 1 year I was there.
Oh, right. Okay. Thanks for that. Something to look out for. Okay. So in terms of then NatureSpace, let's look at the scheme itself and your company. So Sarah, just tell us a little bit about NatureSpace, why it was set up and what you do.
So NatureSpace came about because we Tom Chu and I were having conversations with the NGOs, particularly Amphibian and Reptile Conservation Trust and the Freshwater Habitats Trust, about 7 or 8 years ago. And it was at the time where there was a lot of interest from government into a better regulation and the red tape agenda and how protected species were being dealt with in the licensing regime, particularly great crested newts. And there was also a growing awareness in the environmental sector that perhaps traditional approaches to newt mitigation on development sites wasn't working, wasn't having the desired outcomes. And at the time, Natural England had been looking at developing new licensing policies as a way of broadening the remits of licensing and broadening what could be allowed under standard licensing programs. And the idea of a more strategic approach to licensing was starting to become more embedded. Natural England had started with a pilot in Woking, and we came up with an idea with a group of local planning authorities across the South Midlands to pilot another approach to district licensing. And that's where NatureSpace was born.
Okay, so these pilot studies, and what year were these started then?
So the NatureSpace pilot started in 2018, February 2018, so just over 6 years ago, and then it grew from there. So now we're working with more than 60 planning authorities across quite a large part of England, and the pilot has become embedded as a district licensing approach. In the early days, it was very much a let's see if this works. And in the meantime, Natural England have also developed their own approach to district level licensing, how you do strategic licensing like this alongside or shortly after the planning system.
Okay, so in terms of, I suppose, the problem or you were trying to solve then in terms of different stakeholders that aren't there really. So it's the developers, you know, the maybe also landowners as well. There's the local planning authority. And of course, you know, obviously this is an ecological podcast, so maybe ecological consultants. So in terms of solving a problem for, and of course, newts, great city newts.
Yeah.
Okay, so Sarah, in terms of, I mean, it's impressive now that 60 local authorities are actually on board now, but going back to the root of the, I suppose, a problem for maybe developers, landowners, local authorities, and of course, newts themselves. So, I mean, how has Nature Space, you know, helped each of these, or may, you know, each of these, you know, address a certain problem that they have? So let's look at it from, I mean, the local authority point of view. So how do you take it from being a pilot study to spreading it to these 60 plus local authorities?
Well, yeah, the very first license was granted for 2 years to the first 7 planning authorities. So that was the pilot. And then since then, with the proof of concept, it's working, it's having demonstrable outcomes, and I'll invite Andy to talk some more about that in a minute. More and more local planning authorities wanted to get on board with the scheme. I think the reasons for that were the scheme was designed primarily as a conservation scheme, so it had newt conservation at its heart as a fundamental driving principle. This has to lead to better outcomes for newts, but also it had to work for developers, because otherwise they will never pay into the scheme. They would never pay if it didn't work for them. They have other options. They would use those. And it had to work for planning authorities, because the idea is that this is integrated within the planning system, so you can achieve efficiencies of time and avoid delays and avoid conflicts between what might be allowed in the planning system and what's subsequently allowed in the licensing system. So it was designed to iron out all of those crinkles in traditional approaches to standard mitigation, development mitigation. So we had to satisfy all of those requirements. We had to design a scheme to deliver better conservation outcomes. And now 5 years, 6 years on, we're in a place where we've got lots of data and we can really start to look at what those outcomes are. But it also had to work for the other parties as well. Mm.
Yeah, in terms of, I say, let's look. So, how did the local authorities gain then? So, what problem are you solving for them? How does it work in terms of easing their burden, should we say?
Well, I think when there's a standard approach to survey and impact assessment, mitigation, and on-site compensation, the local planning authorities are having to deal with that decision making on their own. And with Natural England's future licensing decision being completely separated from that part of the process. So you've got the local planning authority weighing up whether or not a development proposal is going to impact on newts, and whether those impacts can be dealt with properly, and whether the planning authority's decision meets the legal requirements set out in the habitats regulations, whether it's meeting their legal requirements to have regard to the requirements of the Habitats Directive, for example. And they're having to make that decision on their own. They're having to decide whether a license is likely to be granted by Natural England at some future date. What this scheme does for them, apart from solving unfortunate delays in having to wait for survey data, is giving them certainty, giving the planners certainty that a license can be granted, because license has already been granted. So they've got that certainty of position in their decision making, that if a development proposal can use a district license, and we have to assess that on a case by case basis, but if a development scheme is coming to a local planning authority and saying, here's my certificate, I can use this district license, then the local planning authority has got that confidence that all of their legal requirements are also met.
Yeah, so you're taking away that, as you say, that uncertainty then in terms of, you know, will Natural England, you know, grant this license application? So satisfying the three tests then. So you're taking on that burden on their behalf, is that correct?
Well, kind of. We're taking on that burden through Natural England as the licensing regulator. They continue to act in that role. Natural England regulates all of the licenses that are granted, whether that's a district license or a standard license. But what we're doing is bringing forward Natural England's decision making, and getting the licensing scheme in place before the local planning authorities are having to make their decisions.
Right. Okay. So you mentioned previously about obviously the data. You know, it's been 6 years now. You collect that data in, and obviously better outcomes for Grosgrestre and Newt. So it may be bringing Andy now in terms of the data then that's been collated and, you know, over the past 6 years. So how does this feature? So why is it important to collect the data, and what are you doing with it?
Well, first of all, this as Sarah said earlier, it is a conservation outcome focused scheme. The whole reason for doing this is to give better outcomes for great crested newts than the standard mitigation licensing that we have been using for the past 30 years or so. So we need to be able to demonstrate that this is in the best interest of great crested newts. So we have a very, very stringent and extensive monitoring and evaluation program that sits alongside it. So we're monitoring not just the compensation ponds that our partners put in the ground, but we are looking at the levels of occupancy and habitat suitability in the wider landscape to make sure that the work that we're doing exceeds the suitability as a general rule, or on the level with the wider landscape. So we have very, very expensive and full on monitoring program we conduct every year. So every pond that our partners have created or restored is monitored with occupancy assessments. So usually EDNA for the first 5 years, and then the number of visits cuts down, but we're still going to be monitoring for the full time that they're secured. We use extended HSI, so Habitat Suitability Index surveys across all of these ponds. So we're visiting them very frequently to make sure that they are meeting the requirements of the standards that the habitat that we create is set within our license. On top of that, we were doing population assessments to make sure that we are not just putting in the ground the odd occupied pond here and there, that the ponds that we are creating are forming a core section of metapopulations, so that they are the real drivers for population in the locations which they're situated, that they're the ones that can be seeding in time, will be the ones that are seeding further expansion of the population. We link all of our assessment of the regional scale to the favorable conservation status metrics. So we evaluating before we get the license what the current status of great crested newts is, based on wider surveys for range distribution, population, habitat, and prospects as well. So how they are, how they're likely to be, the trajectory of the species in the area, and then we are updating that regularly post works. So yeah, very, very intensive evaluation, both pre and during the scheme running.
Yeah, and in terms of that final evaluation, then you've got this data. I mean, is there do you publish this at all in terms of any research papers going on at the moment?
So we are, as Sarah mentioned earlier, just past the 6 year mark. So we're operating on a 5 year cycle. So we've about a year ago came to the end of our first 5 year evaluation cycle, where we have been doing a deeper dive into the data. And I'm sure you appreciate the lead-in times with analysis and getting things published. But we have a couple of things in the works that should be coming out relatively soon. So yeah, we are going to be publishing the data, but academic timeframes mean that it's not out yet. But a lot of this evaluation is based on, in fact, the whole scheme is based around a predictive modelling. So we have species distribution modelling at the core of it, which gives us our lovely five-coloured risk zone map. So white, green, amber, red and black, which allows the impact assessment to look at the likely presence of great crested newts for a development site. But we can also build on that with evaluation. So one of the big pieces of work that I've been doing recently, and I presented on it at the Herp Workers meeting a month or so ago, and I think this will probably have gone out by the time I'm presenting it to Saim next week. One thing that you can do with the species distribution modeling that we use is you can firstly use it to predict that where newts are now. So you look at the landscape variables and where you've got data, and you can identify the suitability of every single point across the landscape on whatever scale you're looking. We used about 25 meter grid across the whole of the region, every region that we're working on. So you can then change the input variables, which with the work that we have done, so where ponds have been lost, where ponds have been created, where habitat has been, what all the habitat changes through development, all the habitat changes through terrestrial improvements that our partners have created. And you can look at the overall suitability of the landscape, just considering the work that you've been doing. And this is what I'm going to, one of the papers that we've been pulling together at the moment, and we're showing even after 5 years, a statistically significant increase in suitability across the landscape based on the district licensing scheme, which is fantastic. And I was not thinking it would be that. I didn't think we would get a statistically significant output on the land, on the scale that we're talking. So for the original area we launched in was about 4,500 kilometers squared. So on that scale, a statistically significant change over just 5 years is huge. It's fantastic to see for the species.
And you mentioned about partners there. So I don't know if it may be a question to Sarah, I don't know, but in terms of partnerships, how are those formed and who are you partnering with other than local authorities?
So we work very closely with Amphibian and Reptile Conservation Trust and the Freshwater Habitats Trust, and we have done throughout the development and operation of the district licensing scheme. But our closest partner now is the Newt Conservation Partnership, which, like Nature Space, was a new entity set up specifically to deliver this scheme. So all of the staff at the Newt Conservation Partnership are experts in freshwater or amphibian ecology and conservation. They're all seconded from either FHT or Amphibian and Reptile Conservation Trust, and their entire reason to be is to deliver the conservation outcomes of this scheme. So they're out on the ground working with landowners and securing habitats, setting management plans, creating the habitats, and then monitoring them and managing them thereafter for the next at least 25 years. So they're our main partners. We developed the original species distribution models with DICE, who'd been really progressing the use of that kind of advanced modelling technique for this purpose.
DICE is the Durrell Institute for Conservation and Ecology at the University of Kent.
Thanks, Andy.
So they've been heavily involved in the development and design of the modelling inputs to the scheme, which underpin it, because there's great crested newts are particularly suited to this kind of strategic approach. They can, their habitat requirements, habitat suitability can be modelled. And you can design a spatial conservation strategy that helps you decide where the good places are across the landscape to deliver those improvements in conservation status. So range, distribution within the range, increases in habitats and increases in populations and improvements to prospects.
Okay, thank you. So I'm going to just change a little questioning in terms of now. Okay, if I was a developer, so I'm submitting a planning application to a local authority, Nature Space is one of the operates within that local authority themselves. What's the process of the developer knowing about the scheme? So where do they get their information from? Where is it? Where did they come from? And I suppose let's run through a little process of, okay, now I've identified Nature Space as an option. Why would I go with Nature Space? So let's go back to that first question then. So how does a developer find out about the scheme itself?
So the local planning authorities who have this option available, they tend to have some information on their websites. And we have a team of district licensing officers who are working, whose job is to support local planning authorities in identifying where impacts on newts might arise through proposed development planning applications, and giving those developers and the planners the full suite of options available. So where newts might be impacted by a proposed development, what are the options for that developer? So District licensing is one of several licensing options. The developer can choose to go out and survey, do their own surveys, wait for the survey season, go out and use that traditional standard approach to ascertaining whether newts are likely to be on or around the development site, and therefore whether they're likely to be impacted by whatever type of development is proposed there. They could do that. And if they find they've got great crested newts, then they've got licensing options. They might be suited for the low impact class license. They might wish to go down the standard licensing route, or they can use the district license. Now, the district license is designed, as we've said already, to present benefits to developers. They don't have to wait for the survey season. They don't have to go and do those new surveys. They can just enter at any point in the year. But at any point during that planning application process, the developer can opt into the district licensing scheme as one of their options. So they find out about it through the planning officer or going onto the planning authority's website and just seeing that suite of options that's available to them.
Okay, so I mean, looking at it from, I suppose, an ecologist's and as an ecological consultant's point of view. Now, probably an ecological consultant is being liaising with their clients prior to anything going into the local authority. So maybe the first knowledge of this scheme or different scheme, should we say, was probably going to be presented by an ecological consultant rather than a local authority. Is that fair?
Yeah, that's true, actually. And so we do try hard to reach out to ecological consultants, and we work with the ecologists in local planning authorities as well, where they are there. And we're trying to get the message out. And a lot, to be honest, is spread by word of mouth, mm-hmm. where people have used, ecologists have used the scheme before and want to use it again because of the benefits that the scheme delivers. So there's that element. The ecologists already know about it. We've got information on our website. We try and get information out there to share with the wider world. For example, the monitoring report, which I'm sure we'll loop back to in a bit, that the New Conservation Partnership have just published. Getting the information to the ecologists, not just on the benefits for developers, but the conservation outcomes of the scheme is also really important.
Okay, yeah, I think that's it in terms of, I suppose, you know, obviously we all want successful outcomes for grey crested newts. That's the ultimate aim for, you know, obviously Nature Space, for ecological consultants and you know, local authorities and a lot of people, you know, so it's a lot of different interested bodies there. In terms of, I suppose, you know, breaking that barrier, you know, if an ecological consultant is going to sell or advise their clients on a particular licensing route or scheme that enables them to, because the developer just wants to get their project finished, you know, over the line, completed. As you say, it may be time sensitive, more than likely it is. There's certainly going to be a budget associated with their proposal as well. Let's look at it from an ecological consultant's point of view. How are you, raising awareness to those local, those ecologists? And also, I mean, here we go. How would you enable us or advise us to maybe promote the scheme over and above others, you know, and where's the balance to be had?
Yeah, so I think, you know, we're always looking for ways to talk to ecological consultants and get the message out there about what the scheme can deliver for their clients, for your clients, and the benefits all of the benefits that we've already talked about. So we're trying to get better at that messaging and communications, and it's a tricky balance, isn't it? Because you can spend a lot of time on social media, and people need information. So getting that information out to people is always really important. We do offer training courses. People can come to us for bespoke sessions, and the team will go along and explain to them about how the scheme works, benefits for clients. So that can sometimes help within individual consultancies. And like I say, trying to really spread the word about the outcomes. And now we've got demonstrable outcomes and publications coming out, then that's information that we can share with people.
Yeah, I mean, that's important in terms of, I suppose, you know, if we look at, you know, the traits, behaviours of agriculture consultants, you know, they're very technically minded in terms of them, you know, they, you know, probably got high ethical value, you know, ethics in terms of, okay, am I only going to promote something if it actually does work and for the benefit of the newts? That's their main area. You mentioned about, okay, yeah, coming back, demonstrable results, monitoring reports. So, you know, how crucial and what is involved within these monitoring reports that may enable like an ecological consultant then to, you know, have confidence within the scheme itself?
So the monitoring report that has just been published by our partners, the New Conservation Partnership, has broken down all of the pond creation that they've been doing over the past 5 years since the original scheme launch in the 7 LPAs. And then, so they've created or restored over that nearly 6 year period, because this was the data and it's up till December 23, nearly 360 ponds have been delivered. And then they also break down the amount of terrestrial habitat that has been created for compensation for the scheme. We're also within this report, this looking at the colonization of the ponds that they're creating, because it is a policy not to seed the ponds that we're creating with newts. We don't want to be transporting them around the country. We don't want to be transferring disease. So we have a very strong policy of natural colonization for all the habitat we're creating. So it is presenting the occupancy rates, and bear in mind that the vast majority of the ponds that we do is pond creation. So they're very, very young ponds. And we're already showing through that off the top of my head, 42% pond occupancy rate. And most of these ponds are within 1 or 2 years of age, which is very, very high. When I have looked for the evaluation at just the oldest set of LPAs, the pond occupancy rate is considerably higher than that. And colonization is moving. It continues up until at least year 4 or 5 with an upward trend. So we're probably not seeing our full occupancy rate of the compensation ponds yet. So that isn't yet reflected in the monitoring reports, because we're not at that stage. It's still a very young scheme in the lifespan of an individual newt. What else is in the monitoring report? So it basically breaks down the compensation that's been provided and the occupancy and HSI data that has been collected over the years alongside it. And they do touch on their levels of impact to make sure that they're presenting that we are well ahead of our legal requirements in terms of pond creation compared to the impacts, the gain multipliers that we have to apply there as well.
Okay.
So I think it's the scale that the delivery is at as well. And, you know, we're not creating thousands of ponds, but we are creating hundreds of ponds that are really well designed in good places to allow newt populations to strengthen and expand and be reconnected across the landscape, with all the benefits that brings, not just for newts, but for the wider biodiversity as well. Mm. And that's considerably more than has been possible to achieve through standard approaches to licensing. And whilst we've all got examples of where individual site-based approaches have worked and can work, equally, there are many, many more examples of where it just simply hasn't worked for one reason and another. It's, you know, whether it's a lack of expertise that the developer has enlisted to help with habitat creation on the development site, whether it's just the type of development and newt conservation, newt survival just don't usually match the houses get occupied and the newts disappear, even if you do manage to retain some decent habitat on site. And then all of the other long-term issues with actually looking after newt habitats for newts. And quite often that monitoring and management just doesn't get done on development sites. There are conflicting management requirements, and the newts lose out long-term, and the survival of the population is by no means certain, and in many cases the population just goes extinct. So what we're doing here is completely different. That doesn't mean there isn't a place for on-site compensation and on-site mitigation in certain circumstances. That's part of this scheme as well, but it is in certain circumstances where there are clear benefits to the newt population, and then proper long-term management and monitoring is secured through the planning process. But mostly what we're doing is delivering off-site compensation, really high quality habitats delivered by experts in good places that are secured for the future. And there is at least 25 years of management and monitoring that is secured through a legal agreement with Natural England. And going back to one of your earlier questions, Richard, one of the benefits for planning authorities is that they have no long-term responsibility for that long-term management and monitoring. We do, and the New Conservation Partnership do, and Natural England regulates and will hold us to account to that. But the developers don't have any long-term responsibilities either. We take that all away. So no matter what happens on the development site, when the developers built the houses and moved on and is thinking about the next site, it doesn't matter because all of the compensation requirements have been dealt with by us, properly secured.
Yeah,
and there's one exception to that, and that is under the Nature Space District Licensing Scheme, we can consider on-site enhancements or creation of habitat, provided it is secured by an HMMP that has very stringent long-term suitability for newt requirements associated with it, and then the developer would maintain a little bit but of a requirement to report to us on the long-term suitability, and we would actually go out and compliance check most of those.
Yeah.
So there is that element that we can and we do consider what is happening on a development site to reduce an impact assessment, reduce the overall impact. But in those circumstances, the developer does need to take on a little bit of long-term responsibility.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So there's part of that, the on-site enhancements, and you mentioned HMP, so that's Habitat Management Plan, is that correct?
Habitat Management and Monitoring Plan.
Monitoring Plan as well. Okay. And followed by the compliance check. So I think this is what, you know, as a maybe a practicing ecologist then, so what, you know, reassures me is it gives you, as you mentioned, the expertise, the knowledge, it's a science-led approach. You've got that consistency as well, you know, and that collaborative approach. You've got those experts in, as I say, so from, you know, the new partnership and yourselves, and obviously, you know, it does benefit multiple stakeholders. As you mentioned, the developers can sort of... it benefits them, yeah, in a lot of ways. But I think in overall, it benefits Great Crested Newts, and I think I can see that, you know, that from this approach.
Oh, I'd expand on that. It benefits a huge variety of things on top of Great Crested Newts. Pond creation landscape is key to freshwater conservation. That Freshwater Habitats Trust, our partners, will bang on about this at length. But creating fresh, clean water, freshwater ponds within the farmed environment, within the wider landscape, has a much, much bigger impact on overall biodiversity than river restoration or other types of freshwater conservation or planting a piece of woodland per unit area. So this scheme is focused on Great Crested Newts, is funded by Great Crested Newts, but we're having a measurable wider benefit to the landscape as well. I was at ponds earlier this week. I was running the New Conservation Partnership's survey training, actually, and they took us to this very big site in the Forest of Dean that they'd been working on for the last few years, and the number of toads that are using that pond, which is a priority species, they're declining across the country. We're actually demonstrably worried about toads. Was fantastic to see. It's been 10 years since I've seen that many toads in one location. So we're having massive benefits on other amphibians. This site that we were at, the local dragonfly recorder had been out to, and it is now their favourite site in the Forest of Dean. So we're having huge benefits beyond just Great Crested Newts. This scheme is designed for wider biodiversity, funded through Great Crested Newts, but Great Crested Newts are key. We have to demonstrate that we are benefiting them, but there's so much else going on.
Okay, well, that perhaps we're going to have a conversation about then, yes, the wider benefits. Now, obviously, biodiversity net gain, for instance, so as this come into as mandatory within England. So, I mean, how does nature space, I suppose, complement, you know, biodiversity net gain? So is there room for, you know, this district licensing scheme, and how does it, you know, impact upon or influence biodiversity net gain? What role do you play there?
Well, the overall message here is that they are completely independent schemes from one another. They are set up differently. They are underpinned by different legislation. You've got the Habs Regs and the Wildlife and Countryside Act and the NERC Act, which sit above district licensing. And then you've got the Environment Act and all of the subsequent secondary legislation that has recently come out for BNG. And they are two separate entities. They're two requirements for the developer that they have to tick the boxes. It's not a pick one or the other. You have to do both. They're both mandatory, species licensing and BNG. They function very differently. That the principles behind them are the same. You create habitat under both of them, but they are for different purposes. But the underlying principles of how they operate are actually quite different. They both have the same similar mitigation BNG hierarchy associated with them, but how compensation is allocated under the district license, we take all of the impacts from across a region, which regions are usually county based in our system, and we pull it, and we take all the compensation across the same spatial scale, and we pull it, and we make sure we are maintaining our gain ratios at that scale. Whereas under BNG, you've got the gain applied to the individual site, you've got the compensation that has to be directly linked to an individual site. So there are fundamental differences between BNG and district licensing that if we were to start selling the BNG value of our compensation sites, which is allowed, provided additionality rules are met, we would have to get around these differences in how compensation is assigned. We'd have to get around differences in how our legal agreements are set up. So as Sarah mentioned earlier, we're underpinned by a NERC Act between the New Conservation Partnership ourselves and Natural England that regulates us. There is no kind of equivalent under BNG, but we have legal agreements with every landowner that we have, which is very similar to BNG, but the function of these agreements isn't the same. We have them too. Private agreements that feed in, that allow the habitat to feed into the scheme, that says the landowner will manage it in the same way, in the way that we need, but they are just private agreements. They have break clauses in them. They have get out clauses, so the landowner can pay us back for the ponds and we will go and spend that money somewhere else. Under BNG, it needs a Section 106 agreement or a conservation covenant to do the same role, which then gets placed onto a national register, which then gets placed onto the local land registry. And a lot of the landowners we're talking to don't want to go down that route. It restricts them much more than they're willing to go through. And we're getting a lot of pushback when we're discussing conservation covenants or Section 106 with landowners. But that doesn't mean we can't integrate the two schemes. Like I said earlier, the use of district licensing compensation can, or creation of habitat can feed into species licensing. It can feed into BNG. The same intervention can have two values. And we are working on ways of how we can get round how we can marry up the compensation assignment so that the value of the habitat that a developer is buying from us can be used across the board for them. We also feel that this will have huge benefits for nature conservation. So if we're delivering BNG alongside our district licensing compensation, we'll be able to fund bigger sites. We'll be able to fund more creation on these sites. We'll be able to fund more diverse sites because we won't necessarily just be thinking about newt conservation. We'll be able to look at fens. We'll be able to do, I don't know, heathland restoration. That's a bad example because heathland's worth nothing in the metric, but we'll be able to look at much more complex, much more broad scale conservation projects and fund these, which will have huger, wider benefits for newts, for other species, for general biodiversity.
Okay, great. Thank you, Andy. So, I mean, you touched on it briefly, you know, on there. What's the future for Nature Space? So where do you go from where you are now? So you've got 60 local authorities on board. I say you do 360 ponds created. What's next?
I don't know, Sarah, do you want to take this one? Or?
we keep doing what we're doing. That's, you know, first and foremost, we keep working with our local planning authorities and we keep doing what we're doing and doing it well. We keep monitoring. We keep building up this incredible amount of data that we've got. And we are working with other local planning authorities. We're working with infrastructure providers. We have secured two licenses for Network Rail for two of their regions. We're working on the final two regions for England at the moment, which operates on a very similar basis to the district license, except it operates outside of the planning system. It's a license to allow Network Rail to carry on its responsibilities as a provider of the nation's railways and to maintain and enhance the railway network, but with access to a much easier licensing system than they would always otherwise have access to. So we're working with infrastructure providers and some very significant, nationally significant infrastructure projects. And, you know, our ears are open to whoever might be interested in exploring a licensing opportunity like this. BNG is something, as Andy said, that we're exploring. The integration of district licensing with BNG has benefits, potential benefits for developers and planning authorities in bringing those two regimes together and having something that's complementary up to a point and making sure that all of those rules around additionality, et cetera, are met. But it, again, it's with a conservation focus and ethos that we want to use this funding to deliver really, you know, better conservation outcomes.
Yeah, I'm really excited about where we're going with Nature Space and moving beyond just the Great Crested Newt project. I've been involved with it for nearly 10 years. It's a great scheme, but the release of BNG recently has brought in so many more options for wider ecological benefits that we can deliver through through the similar types of programs. So, for instance, we could be using BNG habitat and focusing on how that habitat is created and managed for species that wouldn't normally be thought about. We can look at Section 41 species, for example, that aren't usually mandated by local authorities, something that needs to be considered, particularly where large areas are needed, because it's just not financially viable for a developer. But BNG brings that online, and we have many, many sort of ideas of where we can take this to give benefits to nature conservation, to nature recovery, much broader than we are at the moment. And BNG is our link into that. It is our way of making it affordable for developers. So I'm really excited of the future of nature space and that's broadening out.
Okay, thank you for that. So in terms of, moving back to ecological consultants, shall we say. So, I've got this client, obviously it's fictitious. We have this client that, you know, we're advising them on some of these different options. They've got Great Crested Newts or potentially have Great Crested Newts within their development themselves. What considerations should we be considering as within our profession and advice to our clients? And how does Nature Space, the district licensing scheme, benefit, the advice we give or to the developer?
Yeah, okay. So the developer, like we've said, has a choice. The ecologist has a range of options to present to their developer clients on how they might want to deal with their Great Crested Newts and the impacts on Great Crested Newts. And the district licensing scheme offers a really fast and efficient route into a license that can be dealt with at the same time as the planning application is being determined by the local planning authority. So if the developer is keen to get on site quickly, for example, doesn't want to wait for the survey season, wants to cut down post-planning permission delays, doesn't want to have to seek a separate license, then by entering the district licensing scheme during the planning process means that all of the licensing issues are dealt with in respect of Great Crested Newts. This doesn't solve any of the wider potential ecological impacts. All of the normal surveys have to be carried out and impact assessment and mitigation proposals, whatever might need to be done for the wider biodiversity or ecological impacts. And the same with the BNG assessment that still runs. But in terms of newts, which are often the sticking point, they're the tricky species to deal with. It often takes the longest, far longer than anything else. They can enter the district licensing scheme during the planning process, and they can find out exactly how much they're going to have to pay to deal with newts before they even get planning permission. They don't have to pay that whole amount. before they've got the certainty of having planning permission. They enter, they pay a small fee, and then once they've got planning permission, then they can pay the full compensation payment. So they've got certainty pre-planning, and then as soon as they got permission, then they can be authorised under one of the district licences. So it just cuts out loads of uncertainty over timings and costs, long-term costs. They see all of the costs up front. There aren't any hidden long-term, oh, I've got to come back and do some more monitoring type costs in year 8. They know everything up front. They can make a clear decision based on all the facts pre-planning. All they have to do is come to Nature Space, have an assessment, and then they get some paperwork to submit to the planning authority as part of their planning application. The planning authority, if they're granting planning permission, they will apply 1, 2, or 3 planning conditions, standard wording. All the planning authorities have used them multiple times. And they apply these standard conditions to the planning permission, and that's what creates the link between that planning permission and the future use of the district license. And once the developer has paid any remaining balance of their district licensing fees, then they get authorised under the district license and they can proceed as per any requirements. Now, we've talked already about the potential for some on-site measures. This district licensing scheme doesn't assume that everything is lost within the red line development site boundary. There are occasions where it would be better for Newt Conservation to have some retention of important habitats, maybe some enhancement or creation of new habitats where this would benefit the Newt population. And that's taken into account in the net impact assessment and ultimately how much the developer has to pay into the scheme. There is also some potential for mitigation, on-site mitigation measures to try and reduce harm to Great Crested Newts before the destructive works start. And that's reserved for those really high-risk situations where we expect that there might be large numbers of newts impacted. So that's going to be in areas that are identified through the modelling process as high risk for Great Crested Newts. That's the red zones on our impact risk maps, and where the development site is very close or includes ponds within the development site boundary and highly suitable habitat for Great Crested Newts. And in those cases, there might be some mitigation requirements. They'll be reduced compared with standard mitigation requirements, but there might be some just to reduce the really, really high risks in those sort of situations. And when we do the assessment, when the developer comes to Nature Space, having chosen the district licensing option, we undertake a bespoke individual assessment. So our technical team is doing this day in, day out, and we have a very strict set of protocols and procedures that they follow. There's a quantified qualitative metric assessment of impacts on Great Crested Newts, and that determines the three elements of the mitigation hierarchy. It's looking at whether the site should be avoided in whole or in part, because there is potential for some development sites to be very, very critical for the newt population. So, for example, if a development site would result in a loss of range for the species, then that's really serious, and we would potentially have to, you know, look at how to reduce or avoid those impacts so that we can avoid impacts at that scale. We're also looking at how to minimize the impacts on newts using mitigation in high-risk situations. And then the metric also determines the proportionate compensation fee that that development should pay, taking into account the specific impacts, the types and amounts of habitat, not just ponds, but terrestrial habitats, how close those habitats are to ponds, how well connected they are across the landscape, and what the impacts are. So it's a proportionate qualitative assessment of what the cost for compensating for those impacts should be.
Okay, so
the developer then gets that paperwork. Mm-hmm. They then decide whether they want to use a district license, and in most cases people do. They submit the paperwork to the planning authority, and the planning authority has then got that reassurance of a process having been followed that's been regulated by Natural England, and they can rely on that paperwork to say, yes, in this case, the district license is available for this development site.
That metric assessment also defines the compensation requirement that we would have to do for the impact that's being delivered by that development. So it would tell us the number of ponds that we would need to compensate to meet the occupancy and the gain multipliers or ratios that we are bound by, and the area of terrestrial habitat that would need to be delivered to. So when I say terrestrial habitat delivered, that is uplifting habitat into a suitable condition for great crested newts when it wasn't before, that would be needed to be delivered to compensate for the impact from that development site.
Okay, just a couple of questions coming from this. So in terms of I'll come back to fees in a second, but obviously compensation, off-site habitat creation, where does this land come from? Where is this land identified?
Well, we've got a spatial conservation strategy that's part of the license application that goes to Natural England. We have a series of strategic opportunity areas that are identified across the landscape for every region. So this is not a national compensation scheme. This is a regionally based spatial conservation strategy for usually the county and the planning authorities within a particular county. So there's that broad scale spatial assessment that's done largely based on the modelled outputs, but also taking into account other factors in the landscape like barriers and that kind of thing. But on an individual site basis, the Newt Conservation Partnership are looking at using that spatial conservation strategy, but they're also looking for very specific sites. They're looking for sites where they can deliver high quality habitats, clean water, and have sites that are going to contribute to that new population.
Okay, so they're actively looking for sites to bring on board then?
Working with a whole variety of landowners, yeah.
So they're out talking to landowners on a daily basis. They're talking to a huge range. They've got sites that are owned by the MOD right down to hobby farms. So quite a Forestry Commission, Wildlife Trusts, we have compensation on their sites as well.
But council land.
Council owned land. So anywhere that falls within the criteria that they have for a suitable delivery site. So it needs to be able, you need to be able to dig a pond and it will hold water. That's sort of fundamental for pond creation. but it should be being fed by clean water. So we want to reduce arable runoff into it. We want to not have it linked to a stream that might have fish in it, for example. They're looking for the existing suitability of the terrestrial landscape. But beyond that, they're looking for how easily is that site going to get colonized by great crested newts? Is it completely isolated? Is there actually no chance that putting a series of ponds in terrestrial habitat it is actually going to benefit the species? And if they don't think we have models actually that show the connectivity across the landscape, and if there's this area is not going to be linked into where great crested newts are, then there's no point in building there. So there's a huge checklist that they go through to check that the site is suitable before they'll sign an agreement with the landowner.
That's probably an entirely new podcast on the New Conservation Partnership.
yeah, we'll have a look at that. We'll probably bring it on board later on. Yeah, thank you for that. Going back to fees. So in terms of, so when does the developer, first of all, I'm imagining there's a couple of payment plans or something like this, or stages. Initially when they, because you say everything's up front, they know all the costs, so then they can make an informed decision. So but at what stage is the first payment required, and what's that for? And then any supplementary payments as well?
Yeah, so the first stage payment is required pre-planning, but for many cases now we offer an upfront free upfront assessment service, so that people can see before they've paid anything at all what the second stage fee would be, so they can see the fees in their entirety before they pay anything at all. But in order to use the district licensing scheme as evidence for the planning application, then the first stage fee does need to have been paid, because that locks in the developer, their commitment to the district licensing scheme, and it's a full assessment at that point to present to the planning authority. Some cases are just a one-off fee, just a single one-stage fee only. And that's reserved for the really low impact situations. So householders, infill development, genuinely low impact development that's having, you know, potential impact on newts. A newt might turn up during the course of works. It's a bit of an insurance policy in some cases, but it's in terms of population level impacts, it's going to be low impact type activities. Everything else gets a full bespoke assessment, and it's those cases that are split between a stage one fee that's paid pre-planning in order to get that assessment done, get the report to submit to the council. But then the remaining fee, the second stage fee that we call it, is payable after planning permission's been granted. So people aren't having to pay large sums of money before they know if they've even got planning permission. In all cases, all of the fees, whether it's a single stage fee only or it's a split stage one and stage two, the 40% of the money goes straight to the new conservation partnership for habitat creation and the long-term management fund, where they put aside money, secured money for the long-term management of all the habitats that have been created. So that happens with all of those fees. And then on top of that, we send about another 20-25% to the new conservation partnership for monitoring. And then there's a whole load of money spent on supporting local planning authorities, data costs, remodeling costs, reporting costs, renewal costs, etc. But those fees are split across all of the payments that we receive from developers. So it's not that the first stage payment is just paying for a piece of paper. It's also contributing to the scheme, because in this way we can make sure there is that continuous flow of funding for the new conservation partnership to start to go out before a developer has fully entered the scheme, start to go out and be looking for those habitats, new habitat opportunities in the places where development is likely to need it.
Great. Yeah, thank you for that. That's really clear. And so around about 35% goes to operational activities then, really, you know, roughly speaking, broadly speaking.
Yeah.
Great. As I say, you've been very generous with both with your time there. So I'm going to draw today's podcast to a close, but I just wanted to say, Sarah Garrett, Andy Buxton, thank you for joining me today on the Ecology Academy podcast.
Thank you, Richard.
If you enjoy our show and want to help, then please click on the subscribe button and rate us on your favourite podcast player, as that's how you can inspire ecologists in the making, help retain great talent, and provide insights of our industry to a much wider audience of why ecology really does matter. Thank you. And remember, learning is a lifelong endeavour, so stay curious, be adventurous, and build bridges for others to cross.